This episode of Diaries of a Lodge Owner is brought to you by Lake Obabaka Lodge, a rustic luxury fishing lodge.
It was toward the end of the day, and I'm fishing, and I hooked this fish, and it was heavy, like real heavy. And I'm fighting this fish, and I'm thinking I got a lake trout on, to be honest. And because it never tried to come up. Then all of a sudden I got beneath the boat and start bringing it up. I go, oh, I see it. I go, oh, it's a bass. And it's coming up and going, I'm thinking, oh, that's a good one. It might be like 5.5, 6 pounds. And of course, as it kept coming up, it just kept getting bigger and bigger.
This week on the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Network's Diaries of a Lodge Owner, it is our pleasure to throw a few casts with this titan in the Canadian bass fishing world, who has and continues to represent us on the world stage of bass fishing. He has reeled in accolades for well over 3 decades and is well known across our country for his deep knowledge and infectious passion for angling. From serene sunrises on tranquil waters to heart-pounding tournaments, this man of many men embodies the spirit of the sport. And it is now my pleasure to introduce to all of you Canadian bass fishing legend, Dave Chong. On this show, we get to hear Dave's story from throwing darts and golfing at a high level to the determined dedication and hard work it takes to turn fishing into a career in Canada. We expose it all. So if you love interesting stories about awesome people doing really cool things in life and how they got there, this is another can't-miss show, folks. Grab that reel tight as we set the hook into this one. Here's my conversation with Dave Chong. So you've been fishing for many years. So I'd like to just quickly find out what led Dave Chong to the first tournament. Like, and did you have aspirations of being a professional angler your whole life, or like, where did you start?
So there was a moment,
as
there usually is. So, you know, I've always, ever since I started fishing quite late in life, in my estimation anyways. I think the first time I went fishing, I was about 8 years old. And a school mate of mine, his dad was taking him and his brother. They were actually twins, and they asked if I wanted to come along. And we went up to Gannon's Narrows between Pigeon and Buckhorn there.
Yeah,
and that was it. I was totally in love with fishing from that moment on. And I fished every moment I could. I grew up in the west end of Toronto, out in the Hyde Park neighborhood. And, you know, Grenadier Pond was kind of my home waters there. I was off there probably missed a few days of Sunday school and stuff like that because we didn't go to Sunday school. We were down fishing in Hyde Park. But I'll tell you, and then as we got older, you know, I fished every opportunity. All my holidays were basically geared around camping and fishing. And and my brother and I, we fished a lot together, quite a bit.
Yeah.
And once we got into fishing, my parents decided, we have 5 children in our family, so I have 3 sisters and a brother, and they used to. Once I got into fishing and the rest of them started getting into fishing, then literally they'd pile us into the station wagon, you know, 5 kids, and they'd haul us off. You know, we'd leave at like, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and drive to Hastings to fish walleye and, you know, below the dam there and stuff like that. And so we fished as often as we could. But as far as tournament fishing, honestly, I never really thought too much about tournament fishing until it would have been 1989 because it was the 1988 Chevy Mercury, or it might have still been Pro V OV Pro Bass back then. and they had their classic up on Georgian Bay.
Yeah.
And you could actually lock into Gloucester Pool and Little Lake and stuff like that. And but back in those days, believe it or not, that classic, well, it would have been OV because it was Mark Mandick ran it. And they filmed and televised the classic on CBC TV.
No way.
CBC. Not
really.
Yeah. You know, and back then, you know, big CBC was, and it was
CBC. I mean, that was one of the four stations that we could get in my house.
Exactly. Yeah. With your little either rabbit ears or you lucky enough you had a big antenna outside your house, right? So when I saw that was on, it piqued my interest, and Rocky Crawford won it, by the way.
Yeah.
And I watched it and they did a little bit. It was kind of I think the show kind of previewed or kind of had little bits through the season, how everybody got there and everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, you saw Bob Izumi, Bob and Wayne, Nelson and Ray Murakami.
Would Ange and Pete have been there at that point?
I don't think they were fishing. They had fish tournaments before that. Yeah. I don't think they were fishing at that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Hector Peach and Pete Davison. Lots of guys that, you know, are basically legends, you know, from our time. And I watched that, and it was pretty cool, because even at one moment during the classic, there came that moment and they were calling for really horrible weather, and they were trying to decide whether they go or not for the last day.
Yeah.
And Tom Brook from Shimano.
Yep.
I think I don't know if he was the tournament director, he was part of the committee or whatever. I still remember Tom Brook being there, and they were discussing it. You can see them filming their side, and then all of a sudden they're looking at the weather or what they could get. I'm sure their weather forecast was just as good as it is today, you know? and all of a sudden they go, it's a go. And then the word started passing on down through the anglers, and they got ready to go. And anyways, Rocky and it win it. And honestly, that when I watched that, that was the moment that I said, I think I can do that.
That's me.
I think I can, you know, because my brother and I, when we go fishing, we always caught fish, you know. Yeah. We always caught lots of good fish. You know, we were fairly successful whenever we went. And I just think, I'd like to see if I can, you know, how I would do against Bob Izumi and Rocky Crawford and Big Jim McLaughlin, who was Rocky's partner at the time. But obviously in the classic back then, they separated the fish individually, right?
Yeah.
So, of course, that was one of Rocky's, I do believe, four classics that he won. And it was cool. that was the moment. In fact, I know I have that show recorded on a VHS tape, which I probably should digitize it and put it on
CD or
something. And we'll have to
You would ever find it.
We'll have to watch it someday.
Yeah.
Well, it's like even when we have, and you probably remember this, when Dan Carrera had the CFT.
Yeah.
And we had the show on WFN.
Yep.
And who was the guy who was doing the announcements? He's a hockey announcer, commentator. Hockey. Oh my, like famous. Like
the only famous hockey announcer is Joe Bowen, buddy.
I think it was Bowen. Yeah.
No, was it Bowen?
Yeah, he was doing the commentating on the it was pretty wild.
That's awesome.
It was pretty wild. And even I said to Dan, I said, you should digitize all those shows, because he has them. He has all the footage for it. And I think people would love to see that stuff. And
for sure.
You know, some of the history, because, you know, unlike Bassmasters, where you can go back however far and find it on YouTube there and everything.
That's right.
And same with Randy Jennings with Bassing Ontario, because he had TV for his show too. And I know he had talked about digitizing. I think he has done some of them already, but I told him you should put those out so people can watch them, you know.
Sure.
Yeah,
I know. So. I was on Ange for years about digitizing the last cull,
right up in North Bay there.
That's right. The reality TV fishing show that he did in 2004.
Yeah.
And he's, I think we're in the process.
good. That'd be cool because they had Roland Martin up.
Judy Wong and there was a whole whack of them. Chet Douthat. It was a great I'd like to see it.
I remember following that and watching some of it. I didn't get to see it. I don't think I saw all of it, but if it was on now, I'd watch it.
So what did you do for a living before you got into fishing? And how long was the transition between full-time fishing and working?
Wow. So, yeah, I think I was pretty well full-time fishing while I was working. So
weren't we all?
Yeah, it was, it was interesting. So I fished, and at one point I owned a couple of actually camera stores and photo labs because that's kind of my background. I was a photographer. I worked as a professional photographer for many years doing a lot of portraits and especially commercial and corporate portraits and even weddings and corporate events and stuff like that. But I actually have two stores that, you know, had full, you know, mini labs and them processing film and stuff like that. And I actually still ran those up to now you're going to make me think about this. I think 2009 was when we closed the last store.
Gotcha.
So while I was operating stores, I was pretty well, fishing. I'd work like 3 to 4 days a week, you know, but you know, people go, oh, lucky you. Well, no, I'm still putting in the same amount of hours that everybody else at a full-time job. Cause I'd be putting in 12, 13 hours a day, you know, for 4 days. So I still, and then I'd go practice. Well, at one point what I used to do and couldn't keep going on was I'd golf a couple of days and then I'd fish for 2 or 3 days. And eventually I said, you know what? I got to pick one or the other. I can't, I love the golf. You wouldn't know it if you saw me golf nowadays, but I was a decent golfer at one point. But, you know, in my mind was, I don't think I could ever beat Tiger Woods ever.
Yeah. No.
And but do you know what? On any given day, I think I can beat Kevin Van Dam. If things go your way, it could happen. So I'm going to go fishing.
Good for you.
And I basically gave up the golf. And I don't know if I've golfed. And like last time I golfed might have been like 6 or 7 years ago.
Really?
Even then for probably 10 years, I golf like once or twice a year. And that was it. You know, if there was a corporate event going on, I might come out for it and stuff like that. But, you know, one of the things for me, and like I said, about how long I would keep fishing tournaments, as long as I'm competitive and because of my competitive nature, if I'm not good at something, I don't really want to do it.
And there's, you know what?
So when my golf game was, and you know, golf, you have to do it in order to stay, you know, you can't pick clubs up once a year and be good at it. No.
And I'm with you, man. If I'm not good at it, I don't like doing it. So what I did for golfing, because I'm not that good at it. So I decided rather than golf, I would drink. And then that way, when I go out golfing, I'm actually not golfing. I'm drinking, and golf is just the venue where it's happening.
Oh, that's
and
awesome.
I'm good at her, buddy.
That's awesome. Well, the thing is, if we want to go back a little further, my life thing is we're talking about this stuff, and a lot of people didn't know this or don't know this about me. There are some who do, and they're usually pretty surprised when they hear it, but. Before I started tournament fishing, I was a tournament dart player.
Oh, no shit.
And I did that for many, many years. And I did it at a very, very, you know, well, at a fairly high level as far as, you know, Canada goes.
Yeah.
And my claim to fame in darts really is my ex-doubles partner who I used to play doubles and team events with. And we were on the same teams and different leagues and stuff like that. Well, and people in the darting world would know who he is John Part. He's from Oshawa, but he's actually won the world championships 3 times.
No way.
Yeah.
Like 301, 501.
Yeah. In tournaments and stuff, it's generally 501. Occasionally there's cricket matches and stuff like that as well. Yeah. But it's typically 501. And then if you're playing team games, it could be 701 or 801 or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever it might be. It's an 0-1 game. But he moved over to England and
Good for him. Darts is one of my favorite things. But again,
but you can drink better at darts.
Yeah, that's right. I'm better at darts when I'm drinking than golf when I'm drinking.
Well, that's the thing. If you know me, listen, with you, I sit down and have a beer. Yeah. Okay. And people know I don't drink a lot anymore, and they're often shocked when they do see a beer in my hand, or any kind of alcohol, and that's because I tell them during my darting days, literally, I drank enough for a lifetime. I honestly did, you know. I remember kind of toward the end of things, and I was thinking, wow, we used to go play darts like probably 5-6 nights a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of the night, your bar tab is, you know, you're buying drinks for people. They're buying you drinks. And next thing you know, you get your bar tab and it's $80-$100. And you think about that 5-6 nights a week. That adds up a lot of money over the year.
Oh, yeah. A lot.
It's almost as bad as people who smoke and think about how much they spend when they're smoking. But, So a lot of people don't know that about me. So I guess after this, they might.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
So did you ever play any tournaments over in England or over?
I did not. I've played mostly. We had some, the bigger tournaments around here were like Motor City and Oshawa and then Steel City down in Hamilton. So we had, you know, lots of tournaments, but nothing like in England, honestly.
Yeah, like, I mean, England, I was hoping to get one of those stories because their fans crazier than shithouse rats. Like, they're all wasted. Yeah. Like, when you get Scotland and England playing against each other. And I like watching those dart tournaments just to watch the fans. The fans
are insane. And they're dressed up in costumes. I've been watching. I still follow it, you know, because, you know, especially while John was playing, I would follow it all the time. And I know he tried to re-qualify for the pro tour again this year, and he didn't make it. But he still does. He still does appearances over there and stuff like that. He's still a great player. But that's where I can tell you. There was one point between the two of us, you know, we play, you know, we go back and forth. We play and he'd win one, I'd win one, he'd win one, I'd win, blah, blah, blah. If I played him now, we could play 100 games in a night. And I can tell you right now, I would not win one.
but you haven't been practicing.
I would not win. Well, absolutely, I haven't been practicing. And that's kind of the same as golf. Yeah. You know, once I decided I wasn't going to play the leagues anymore, because we used to play 3 leagues a night. And then, like I said, we spend 2 or 3 other nights going around just playing at different venues and just playing people. When I decided to give up the league play and everything, I didn't practice. I didn't do anything anymore. And of course, like it's the same as golf. It's a lot of muscle memory. Occasionally alcohol does play a part. I actually did know players, believe it or not. And some people just don't believe, but you have to see it. And the drunker they were, the better they played.
Yeah.
For
me, you know, I don't drink a whole lot anymore. Once I bought the lodge and as a lodge owner, I really basically quit drinking.
Yeah, responsibilities.
Wow, responsibilities. And and I didn't want to become an alcoholic. Like, I mean, at the law, and it's a predisposed condition for lodge owners. It really is. I didn't believe it, but when I started looking into it,
I could see that.
Yeah, and now that I've been a lodge owner and I've seen things from that perspective, the drinking part, like, I mean, people come to see you and they want to see you, and you know, as soon as they hit your dock at the lodge, they're partying.
Yep.
And they want you to be part of it. Hey, Steve, come on over and have a beer. You know, here's a cigar. Right. And if I wanted to, and the stress of owning a lodge made it very easy to make the decision to be drunk every day for free.
Yeah.
It was right there. It was right there.
I totally see that. I can totally see that. Yeah.
So I really quit drinking at that point. But with darts, like, I mean, I did feel better throwing darts after one or two beers just to loosen up.
I'm exactly the same. I never was one of. I'm one of those guys. I'd get to a certain point.
Yep.
And then if I'm over it, then my game goes
fell right off the cliff.
But honestly, I knew guys who, if they couldn't walk a straight line and they were stumbling, you probably didn't want to play them. it goes against all common sense. But there were people like that. And one of the things was, and it's funny that you said, you know, you stopped it because they didn't want to become an alcoholic. And that was one of my things when Bob Seneve, who was the Canadian dart champion at the time, approached John, because John was quite a bit young. He was probably 10 years my junior.
Yep.
And 8 to 10 anyways. And so people saw the potential in him because he was so young. And Bob Seneve came up to him after one tournament and asked him if he'd play doubles with him. And John came to me and says, yeah, you'll never guess. Seneve came and asked me, he goes, I said, well, what'd you tell him? He goes, well, I told him no. I said I played darts with Chonger, you know. I'm going, you're an idiot. I'm going, you go back and tell him right now that you're going to play with him, because I don't know how much longer I'm going to do this, because that was one of my concerns that I was going to become an alcoholic doing this.
I know. So did he go back and?
Yes, he did, and then his career just kind of.
Kind of
took off from there. And,
yeah.
But he always had that cocky nature about him, right? Some people, obviously, you know, some people don't take that as being arrogant or I think it's just being self-confident, you know.
Yeah.
It's the same with some anglers, some tournament anglers, you know. I know, I've known Rocky since I started playing, and I know there are people who thought of him as being arrogant, but I never ever, me personally, he was always so good with me. Like when I asked him questions, you know, he was just very self-assured. He knew what he was capable of doing, and I guess to some people it comes across as arrogance and cockiness, but I just thought he was very self-confident. He just, you know, he knew.
Yeah. So, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No, I think
makes people great.
I think that's part of, well, that's exactly the thing with John, right? He was, when I met him, and we met in a bar.
Yeah.
The Rose and Crown at Young and Eglinton there. And nice. I lots of people there. I met Doug Bunker, who ran the Aurelia Perch Festival for 40 some odd years.
Oh no.
I met him in there before we knew either one of us fished at all. We That's met there having beers and playing darts. But
it's a great game.
Yeah. When I met John, he had just finished college. He was like 21. And I said, oh, you're done college. Well, what are you going to do now? He goes, well, I'm going to become a professional dart player.
Good for him.
And I looked at him like, it's kind of like, you know, we obviously know we can do it now because of what Chris and Corey and Gussie and Cooper, all what they've done making the elite circuit and stuff like that. But go back past before any of them ever make it. We had Hank Gibson who did fish, and we have some history as Canadians on the Bassmasters tour. But before that, if somebody came up to you and you know, some young kids said, yeah, I'm going to become a Bassmaster Classic champion.
Yeah.
You'd look at them like, I know. Sure, buddy. go have a couple more.
I know.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's great. Yeah. No, so darts, eh? That's wonderful. Yeah. Even to this day, I've never hit a 180. I had a dartboard in my basement, and every time I walked downstairs for 10 years, I'd grab my darts and throw, and the best I could do was, you know, two triple 20s and then just bending the wire a couple times, but, you know.
Yeah. I've hit a few, but nothing like what these guys do nowadays. They're just...
Every game.
Oh, every game. I don't know if you're watching any of it lately.
No.
Luke Lidler, he made it to the finals of the world championship he was still 16 at the time.
No way.
Yeah, he just turned 17 and now he's on the pro tour. And he's, oh my God, it's incredible. When you get a chance, look up Luke Lidler. You'll go, this is phenomenal. Like, honestly, it's phenomenal. It's gonna make darts grow huge. Just the same as over here with all the young kids now, you know, on the tour and on the elites and, you know, even up here, you know, with Coop and, you know, the guys. And now we've got a few other, you know, I know his partner, Danny McGarry, has been trying to get, you know, qualify through the opens and, Evan Kung right now, he's leading the EQs, the elite qualifiers.
Yeah.
So
no,
it definitely, it can happen. It takes
this one. It's like the 4 minute mile.
Yep.
You know, once people believe it can be done, then all of a sudden it's just like your buddy, John, I am going to do this.
Oh,
right. And when you decide that, there's nothing that you can't do.
So
I had that moment. Like I had that moment where I decided that I was going to be a lodge owner, and that was it. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Right.
And you did it.
I did. Yeah.
It was how many years did you,
it was 10.
10 years. Okay. 10 years, I was going to say 10, 12 years. I knew it was a good long time, you know?
Yeah. No, it was a great run. A
couple more, you might have become an alcoholic. You know?
I know. Well, it was like you said with the tournament fishing last year. You had that first year where you know you had that feeling of You know, the last couple of years, there was situations that I just I forget what they even were. They were just days where I thought, you know, I think I'm not.
If you're not enjoying it anymore, you know, you have to reevaluate things, right? Yeah. And rethink.
Yeah, and being away from my family at that point after a decade weighed very heavily on the decision.
Because how many months were you away? I remember you when you were gone. You were gone.
Yeah, like I mean, I was gone from. As soon as I could get in there, which typically was about the third week of April when the ice left. Right. So I was there from the third week of April until about 2 weeks after Thanksgiving. In October. And I would go home one day a week. I'd leave Sunday after dinner. I'd drive the 4 hours home. By that time, everybody was in bed. I'd wake up. I'd put the kids on the bus, give my wife a kiss as she's going to work. And then I would pick up all my fresh produce and start back to the lodge.
That's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's hard with the family. See, in my case, I'm lucky. We only have furry kids.
Nice.
And they don't, you know, you can be gone.
Yeah, you can let them back by themselves
and still,
for a while.
And they're still, you know, thrilled to see you and everything.
Oh, you could lock them in the trunk of a car for a couple of days. And when you open that lid, that puppy is so happy to see you, man. you do that with your wife, she'll knock you out.
No, my wife is super understanding, and she's been very great. Supportive of my fishing career. You know, that's important. I mean, that's
sure
important.
It is.
I mean, it's the same for you as a lodge owner.
100%.
You know, if you didn't have your wife behind you, wow, you wouldn't have lasted that long.
No.
Either that or you've been divorced.
That's right. And I'll be honest, there were a few times in my lodge career, I wasn't sure if I was going to go bankrupt, get divorced, or become a millionaire.
Yeah.
But I'm just glad that the latter happened and not the first two.
Yeah. So you survived and.
Yeah. Yeah. So listen,
now you're on a different path.
Yes. Yes, I am. And I'm not sure where that path is leading, but we'll find out.
Yeah.
But before we leave the past with Dave Chong, what are some of the most memorable fishing moments for you in your early career?
Wow.
Pick one or two.
Wow.
Great stories. Doesn't even have to be about fishing.
Well, I'll tell you one that was a real kind of high and a real low too. And although the low wasn't as bad for me, so
yeah,
I started fishing different tournaments, and I fished some top bass and some of the smaller circuits and Bassing Ontario. Bassing Ontario had a 1-day circuit back then, but our aspiration was always to go fish the GM Pro Bass. You know, Mercury GM Pro Bass Tour, which was came out of the OV Pro Bass. And so we started fishing it, and we went and fished it the first year. And I think we missed making the Classic by maybe 3 or 4 spots. We were close, but we just missed making the Classic. And that was when it meant something to make the Classic. It really meant something to make the Classic. I mean, names like, you know, Izumi and stuff, there were years and they didn't make the Classic. They didn't have a good year. You didn't make the Classic. It wasn't a given for anybody. And in the second year, at the end, the last event of the year, everybody sticks around because they announce who makes the Classic. And back then, if you made the Classic, you were fishing for a truck and a boat package.
That's a big deal.
Back then, it was a huge deal. It was a huge deal. So anyways, they announced, I was fishing with Rob Lee at the time, and they announced us making the Classic. And I was just thrilled to have made the Classic because, unfortunately, back then, the Bassing Ontario Classic and the GM Pro Classic were on the same weekend. And I was fishing both tours. And I had already qualified for the Classic with Joe Figuera. At that time, and I already committed to him that I would fish that with him because Classic was a team Classic, right? Whereas, like I said, with the GM Pro Bass, you split up and fish as individuals. But, you know, I was happy just to can say I was a Classic qualifier.
Yeah.
And Rob Lee was looking forward to going and fishing the Classic, which was down on Lake Erie that year. And awesome. we were afterwards went and had a nice dinner. We were always... you know, we're just excited. We made it. We're there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then we got the call the next day from Michelle, who ran the circuit, and she said, "Oh, we made a calculation error.
Oh,
you guys are actually the first team out, or first guys out."
No. So you didn't actually make it.
So we didn't. So for me, I was already going to go fish the Classic on Lake Simcoe, but Rob was just devastated.
Oh my God.
He was so excited. He loved Erie. He was so excited he was going to go. So it was a high having made it. And then, but I'll tell you, since then, through the different variations of the Chevy Mercury, tour, and then when it became the CFT, I do believe Doug Brownridge and myself, that was the last year I missed the Classic. And
oh, really,
I can't remember exact number. It's 20 some odd years that we made the Classic every year.
Wow.
Yeah. Doug and I had the same
record.
Run. Yeah, that Doug and I had the same run. It was, we were the only two that I was aware of. Everybody else at some point missed it, you know.
Yeah.
Because you knew everybody then, right?
Yeah.
You knew, him and I. So that's an accomplishment. I'm proud of, you know.
Good for you. Well, and so you should be.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, him and I have won a Renegade Classic. Rob Lee and I have won a CFT Classic. So, and we've won Team of the Years, and of course, all those are all highlights. And
yeah,
you know. Other than those which are givens, I guess probably the ones that a couple that come to mind is you. Did you know Greg Roth?
Yes, I did.
Okay,
I knew Greg. Yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, you know, I know he passed. Yeah,
passed away, and so
he was actually a contestant on The Last Call.
He was. That's right.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. Now you mentioned, I remember that now. But Greg and I are the only two people to have won a divisional on the club side, like with the nations, like the Bass Nation and the Bass Federation. So we won with Team Ontario up on Georgian Bay in for some reason I forget the year, but then we were on the team with the TBF Team Ontario, and we won the divisional there as well. So we're the only two people up here who've won in both federations.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. And of course, lately we've been doing international fishing.
Well, I wanted to go there. I wanted to talk about the Pan Am games.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the first year that you made?
2018.
So that was Mexico.
Yeah, no, that was on Florida on Lake Okeechobee.
Okay.
And there was no qualifying process at that point. At that point, first of all, I know people were going, "Whoa, what happened?" And well, what happened was we basically, Canada got invited, and Bob Izumi was tasked with putting together a team. And literally, it was on very short notice. I think we had like about 3 weeks to get a team together. And so he approached me and a bunch of other guys. Anyways, we went down and we managed to finish second to the Americans. How many countries were
involved?
So that year, there was just four. And there was Mexico, U.S., Canada, and Costa Rica.
Gotcha.
In four countries. And then in 2019, the Pan Americans actually took place right here in Cornwall on Lake St. Francis. And we beat the Americans for the team gold, nice. Which is obviously a highlight because the American team consisted of, and I'll rhyme off a few names, well, Scott and Roland Martin.
Yeah.
Okay. Jacob Wheeler. Dustin Connell, John Cox, who else was there? Jacob Poroznik, Cody Meyer,
wow,
Ryan Latimer, Mark Daniels Jr., Keith Carlson. Yeah.
Those are big names.
Pretty tough, tough. Now, they won the individual pairs gold, but...
Yeah, well, the team
gold. We won the team gold, so.
Yeah.
As the world gets louder and louder, the lessons of our natural world become harder and harder to hear, but they are still available to those who know where to listen. I'm Jerry Ouellette, and I was honored to serve as Ontario's Minister of Natural Resources. However, my journey into the woods didn't come from politics. Rather, it came from my time in the bush and a mushroom. In 2015, I was introduced to the birch-hungry fungus known as chaga, a tree conch, with centuries of medicinal use by indigenous peoples all over the globe. After nearly a decade of harvest, use, testimonials, and research, my skepticism has faded to obsession. And I now spend my life dedicated to improving the lives of others through natural means. But that's not what the show's about. My pursuit of this strange mushroom and my passion for the outdoors has brought me to the places and around the people that are shaped by our natural world. on Outdoor Journal Radio's Under the Canopy podcast, I'm going to take you along with me to see the places, meet the people that will help you find your outdoor passion and help you live a life close to nature and under the canopy. Find Under the Canopy now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Escape to the wilderness of Lake Obabaka Lodge, where the exclusivity of a fly-in meets the accessibility of a drive-to destination. Cast its pristine waters teeming with trophy lakers, northern pike, and smallmouth bass. Discover a paradise rich with history, offering serene moments and adventurous days. Lake Obabaka Lodge is where memories are hooked and history comes alive. Join us where the wilderness whispers your name.
So what's it like fishing for your country in a setting like that?
It I can't tell you how much it means to me, especially at this stage of my career. Because I'll this is another history thing, but I'll tell you a story.
Yeah.
So many years ago, way before the 2018 Pan Americans, I got a call and they said, "Hey, they're thinking of holding a Bass World Championship in Mexico. Would you be interested in going down and representing Canada?" And at that time, I was more focused on trying to win big tournaments and possibly at some point get to the Bassmasters Classic and stuff like that. And, you know, I asked, I said, you know, what's involved? You know, what do we have to do? You know, what are we fishing for? You know, and basically it came down to, and it's the same right now, you're fishing for medals and national pride.
Yeah.
There's no money involved. And I'm going, okay, and who's going to pay for this? And when they told me, well, you're pretty well, you have to cover your own expenses. I thought, yeah, I'm not really interested.
That's tough.
And I passed on it. And then I didn't hear anything about it for a long, long time. And then all of a sudden, Scott Martin, who you know has a huge YouTube following.
Yeah.
He's got more of any angler out there. And all of a sudden, I saw this thing. Oh, Scott Martin at the 14th annual World Black Bass Championships in South Africa. And I'm doing the math and going, oh, that's when they, yeah. So that's when they asked me that it's been going on
14 years since
that time. And Canada's never, it was not a part of it.
Really?
It was not a part of it. We never sent a team and we're never a part of it. And yet there's countries, like there's five countries from Africa. There's Italy, France, yeah. Spain, Portugal, Croatia, Serbia, Korea, Japan, Philippines.
Wow.
Mexico, of course.
You got to get on that, Dave. Now is the time.
Well, what happened was then we got invited to the Pan Americans, right?
Yeah.
And did that. And because of that, they invited us to, which would have been, I guess, the 15th or 16th annual World Championship down in Mexico.
Ah, okay.
And we went and competed there. Sean McCall, Joe Ford, myself, Rob Lee, Cole Bailey, and Bruce Leeson.
Gotcha.
And we finished fifth out of 22 countries there.
Wow.
So, and then, yeah, of course, and like I said, in 2019, we hosted the Pan Americans here, and then we've been to, not myself, but Canada has sent a team to the Worlds every year. We missed 1 year in South Africa because the World Organization, if you ask me, they're not as organized as they should be.
Yeah.
And we fished the World Championship in Mexico, and they asked us, are you going to come to the World Championships? I do believe it was in Zimbabwe. And, well, it depends on where it is. Well, we'll let you know. Well, them letting us know was basically like a month before the event was going to take place.
Oh, no.
And going, there's no way we can get things together.
So as a lodge owner and an event coordinator, basically, mm-hmm. at the lodge, I'm very interested to hear about how this whole thing was organized and looked after. Like, did they have a place for you to stay? Did you all stay in the same spots? Was this, again, you foot the bill to get there?
So because Canada, which is and our international stuff is overlooked by the CISA, the Canadian International Sport Fishing Association, still very much in its infancy.
You know,
we've only been in operation since 2018, and we'd like to get to the point where, if we send a team, that we could fully fund the team, cover their travel expenses, hotels, cost to get there, et cetera, et cetera. We're close. We're not quite there. It takes a long time. USA Bass has a lot more. They've obviously been operating a lot longer than we have, and they have a lot more corporate support and everything. So I'm sure all their teams are fully funded. And some of the countries are very, very, how do I put it? Their pockets are full.
Really?
Is a thing. For instance, when we did let's give you an example. We did the Worlds in Mexico.
Yeah.
So there's like a 1 month off limits period before you can practice and everything. So obviously the Mexicans were already there, so they could practice before that, and then they have to stay off that water.
So it's a month.
Yeah.
Before.
So
and then you're allowed to pre-fish for a week before?
2-3 days depending on the event. So South Africa and Spain both sent their teams over a month before, so they can go practice, you know.
I want to be on those teams.
That's not cheap, you know, when you're sending people across the Atlantic.
No.
You know, you're
there for 2 months. Well, did they come back for the month?
No, they went back.
Yeah.
And then they came back, but still, it's another
thing.
And here's even a more amazing thing is Team Spain, when they came over a month beforehand and practicing, they bought 3 bass boats.
No way. Where? In Mexico?
In Mexico. So they'll be there when they come back for the World Championships. And they used them. And I don't know if they sold. I would assume they sold them before they went back. But anyway, that's the kind of money some of the countries, you know, federations have, right? We're still in our infancy, so far a lot of costs have been covered for by ourselves, and we try to do a little bit of fundraising, and we're doing more of it. The CISA, we have a corporate pro-am every year now. When we host the Pan Americans this year in September,
and that's in New Brunswick, right?
In New Brunswick on the St. John's River, and in Fredericton and Nakawik. And
it'll be a lot of small, or is it striped bass you're fishing, or is it smallmouth or largemouth?
They have a very good population of smallmouth down there.
Yeah.
But largemouth have made their inroads, I do believe, from Maine into some of the watersheds, and the St. John River is one of them. Currently, they're being treated as an invasive species.
Wow, the muskies
and the muskies are kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
You can't bring largemouth to the scales and most tournaments down there. So we're hoping
they don't even let you bring them to the scales.
No, we're hoping that the minister will grant us a variance for the event at least. And kind of go from there, but we don't know yet. Things are still being worked on as we lead up to the event. But right now, I do believe we currently have 10 or 11 teams, countries committed.
Beautiful.
Canada, U.S., Mexico, Puerto Rico, Costa Rica. Because they've added another element to the event now, the International Cup. So South Africa is coming. I can't think of all the countries, but right now I think there's at least 11 countries that are coming. And that's literally, cool. This event will put New Brunswick on the bass fishing map.
Absolutely.
Worldwide. When they see how good the fishing is down there.
Yeah.
It's going to be amazing.
They've got wonderful fishing there. Yeah. The muskies too. The fact I'm assuming if they're treating the largemouth like invasive species, that whenever they trap them in the nets before they go over the Mactaquac Dam, and there's a bunch of power dams there where they actually transport the salmon and the trout and everybody up to the top of the dam, they kill the muskies. I'm not 100% sure if they're still doing it today, because there have been some wins as far as muskie angling goes. But I certainly hope that at some point they realize that
I think a big part of it is, you know, it's always been the Atlantic salmon.
That's the big part. And people hate everything that they perceive is hurting them.
Yeah.
But it's not muskies eating them. It's not bass eating the fry. Yeah. It's not that they're competing with them. It's really the weather is changing.
Yeah.
The temperatures are changing. And I think you've got to, rather than hold on to something that is not sustainable anymore or like it used to be, embrace the things that are happening, right?
I don't know for sure, but I'm sure there's other factors like environmental, like you mentioned, could be one of them. I mean, it's just the species itself doesn't adapt very well and stuff like that. Well, you look, how many years have they tried to establish them in Lake Ontario? How many years?
There's so much.
I've caught one.
I haven't.
But I've literally caught one.
One.
Yeah. I've caught one. Now I know other people have caught more than that, but they're not being established. Yeah.
No. Yeah. No. No. It's not
working. It's the same with Lake Simcoe, and when they tried to reestablish the muskie population there.
Yeah.
And they spent many, and like you said, millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And I've honestly have seen one tiger muskie on Simcoe in my entire lifetime.
Yeah, I've never seen a muskie on Simcoe, and I've fished it quite a bit. Like, I mean, it's fairly close to where I live, and you know, lots of everything else, no muskies.
Yeah. So at some point, give it up.
Yeah, 100%. So when you were down in Mexico, how big were the, like, what is your biggest, okay, never mind Mexico. I want to know the story behind Dave Chong's biggest bass.
Oh, well, my biggest bass, believe it or not, is a smallmouth.
Well, I probably wouldn't have guessed a smallmouth, but it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. And it was on Lake Simcoe, and it was caught in, 2014, and it was according to the digital scale, and I borrowed at that time I didn't carry a scale on board, because for tournaments I used the culling beam, and I never used the scale. That's why when I used to come in, people go, how much do you have? And I go, I don't know, I have my five biggest fish. That's what I know. And so sometimes my guess would be off. And then, of course, they turn around and say, you sandbagger, I thought you only had 17 and you had 19. And I'm going, I don't weigh them. I honestly don't know, you know?
And just explain what a culling beam is. I know what it is, but just for people listening.
Oh, a culling beam is basically a balance beam. And you literally hook one fish up on one side, and you hold it up, and whichever side it goes, one drops. That's the heavier fish. That's the truest way of telling, because you know you put a fish on a scale, and it goes
bounces up
0.3,
and down
0.5, 0.3, 0.5, and you know which one is it? But
anyway, a great tip for tournament anglers.
Yeah, it's fine. The scales nowadays are getting much better. Bubba just introduced that fancy $300 scale, which I have one, so I'll use it this year and see what it works like. But anyways, so I didn't have a scale, and so Actually, I'll tell you the day I had Steve Nephew out with me. And he had never fished Simcoe very much. And I fished a few tournaments with Steve and got to know him actually because we traveled together for one of the divisionals down to Vermont. And so we became good friends. And he said, well, come on out. I'll show you what Simcoe fishing is all about. In the fall, it's obviously the best time on Lake Simcoe.
Yeah.
And we went out there. And so we launched the boat and he launched me. And then he comes back, and as I'm just pulling away from, like, oh, damn it, forgot the net. It's in the back of the truck. We better go get it. And in the back of my truck, I had my regular bass net, which is a pretty big one.
Yeah.
And then I had my pike net, which is like a really big one. It's more like a salmon net, right?
Yeah.
And I said, Steve, just go in the back of the truck and grab a net and thing. So he trots up and I'm watching him come down and he's trotting down with the big giant pike net. and he gets there and I'm going, okay, you think we're going to catch like a giant fish today or something? I go, the other net would have been plenty. Anyways, he's there with it. We took it in and we went fishing. Anyways, it was a fairly tough day. And we had only, I think at the time I caught that big fish, we had caught like maybe 6 or 7. You know, there were a couple like that were 5, 5.5, like nice fish. Yeah. And it was toward the end of the day and I'm fishing and I hooked this fish and it was heavy, like real heavy. And I thought, but it didn't come up. So I caught it. It was probably, my bait was probably about 17 feet down over about 24 feet.
Yeah.
And I'm fighting this fish and I'm thinking I got a lake trout on, to be honest.
Laker.
And because it never tried to come up. Then all of a sudden I got beneath the boat and started bringing it up. I go, oh, I see it. I go, oh, it's a bass. And it's coming up. I'm thinking, oh, that's a good one. It might be like 5.5, 6 pounds. And of course, as it kept coming up, it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And then it gets up and then it shoots away from the boat and it actually does try to jump, but it was too fat. It kind of did one of those wallows and landed down there. And I finally get it to where the boat and go, get that net underneath it. And he gets the net underneath it and lifts it up into the boat. And literally, we're both standing on the back deck and we're staring down, looking at the fish going, how big is that thing? I'm going, well, I've caught lots of sevens and this one is well over 7. I don't know. Is it 8? Is it 9? Is it 10? I honestly don't know. I've never caught one that big. And I'm going, I don't have a scale. And I'm thinking,
oh no.
I'm thinking, Steve, you might have to drive over to Cabela's there and buy a scale. You know, we put in a live well and thing. And then I realized I saw Taro Murata out there guiding. And I go, I know he has a scale because his client don't want to know how much.
Sure, for sure.
So I go, I know where he was, so I'm sure he's not too far. So we went out, and sure enough, there he was. And go, hey, I need to borrow your scale. I need to weigh a fish. He goes, why? Is it big? Yeah, it's biggest fish, biggest smallmouth I've ever caught. And I took the scale out. We took the fish out, and he pulled it out. And he goes, oh, and he didn't even have a good scale. But this is Taro. If you know Taro, he's a great angler. He's a great guide. Yeah, but most of his equipment's on the ghetto side. So he has this Rapala scale, and it looks like it's been through hell and back.
Uh-huh.
And I put it on there, and finally it settles in, and it says 8.2.
Wow.
And I'm going, wow, it's over 8 pounds. I'm thinking the thing. He goes, oh, my scale always weighs 0.5 pound light.
Oh my God! No so way.
Basically, you know, it according to the scale, it was probably 8.7.
Wow!
And so we kept in live well, got it all settled, took a bunch of pictures, and then made sure she was good, and then we let her go.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So the thing was, I don't know if you remember the new Ontario record, which was just caught down on Lake Erie last year by the guys from Stateside who were fishing over there, which was just over 10 pounds. Well, the dimensions of my fish.
Oh no.
Were almost, well, they had about 1 inch on me in length.
Yeah.
But my fish probably had 1.5 inches on girth on it.
Oh my God.
So,
you know what that means?
Who knows?
You know what that means.
Who knows?
That shit Rapala scale was weighing a hell of a lot lighter than
who knows?
That.
Who knows? It might have been, but I call it an 8.7, but that's that is my biggest.
I think that was the record.
It could have been. You know,
hey, listen, I can tell you with confidence that I do believe that there is a world record smallmouth in Lake Simcoe.
Oh, I do. 100%. 100%.
For sure.
I'm just waiting for somebody to catch the first double digit one, which it's going to come, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you this. I've hooked a fish that I didn't land that I swear was bigger than that one I caught.
I believe it.
It jumped and it came off. And it was, I don't even know how it jumped. It was so big. It was just a big black frying pan when it jumped.
I've only ever had one like the ones that you're talking about. And it was the same thing. I was on Simcoe pre-fishing a tournament. And I was out on Big Shoal just behind Georgina Island there between Thora. Well, Thora's quite a bit further, but right on that Big Shoal. And I'll never forget, it was a Yozuri lipless crankbait. They make those ones that you've got the 5-footer and the 10-footer and you know. And it was one of the shallow running lipless crankbaits. And I threw it out at the shoal, at Big Shoal, and hooked into this fish. And I thought it was a northern. Like, I mean, it hammered it and then just in one big swipe, grabbed my bait and took off. Never broke water right away. And then once I got the fish under control, I started winning on it. And it come right up out of the water. It was the only time I saw it. And I was working on actually filming a TV show back then called Fish Fever. A buddy of mine and I, this was after the last call. We thought, wow, we can do a fishing show like this, And we were out there, and Darren was the guy that was running the camera, Darren Irani. And
I know Darren.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I know Darren. He was a member of our bass club for quite a few years.
Yeah. Nice. Well, if you ever see him kicking around, you tell him that I say hello.
I haven't seen him in him and his buddy Vince, they joined our club when they were like probably like 15, 16 years old.
Yeah. Well, I run into them down at Ryerson University. They were in video videography and all that stuff.
Yep.
So Darren was in the boat with me, and this fish broke water. And like you said, it was so fat. Like, I mean, it looked like a football that was shaking. They almost don't even look real because the whole body moves. It's like a lumbering boom. Anyway, it spit the hook, and Darren was yelling at me, "Oh, it's a hog. It's a hog."
Hey, listen. You're not that far away from where I lost that one that I think was bigger than that 8.7 that I had. And it was, unfortunately, when you hook them on, like you say, a lipless, any trouble, and mine was on a jerk bait.
Yeah.
Which is just a thing, you know, you should never be surprised if they come off of that because that's one thing you learn. And like I tell people when I talk about jerk baits and stuff is, first of all, you have to realize you're never going to land every one of them.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. It's just, you know, so.
We interrupt this program to bring you the much anticipated bonus code for the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Network's giveaway. This week's code is Rustic. That's capital R-U-S-T-I-C. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 free entries towards a Garmin LiveScope Plus system. For those of you who aren't entered, what are you waiting for? Head over to fishincanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode, click contests, and sign up for all the latest Fish in Canada giveaways. For next week's code, tune into the Under the Canopy podcast. Now back to the episode.
So now that we've heard these big fish stories, before we wrap this up, I know that there's a lot of people out there, including me, who are wondering, what is the best method to fish these fish to ensure good hookups? You know, I know it's not a chug bug topwater, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So what when you're concerned about pinning those fish, how are you fishing them?
Well, obviously, you know, like we already mentioned it. Anytime you're using a lure with treble hooks,
yep,
that's one thing against you. Yes. You're just it's tough.
I think it's because of the leverage, right?
Yes,
the fish has the leverage, and then once another treble hooks them in a different spot, and then there's it's the leverage points.
Yeah. So a single hook, and obviously even a single hook, it really depends on where you hook the fish.
Yeah.
You know, but you know when you get a single hook and you hook them right in the horn.
Yep. Right in the beak.
That is, it's never going to come off. And I when it comes to fishing, I avoid using the words always and the word never.
Yeah.
Because that's just not the case in fishing, because it always can happen. For instance, and this is kind of funny because I'm going to be fishing the Pan American Games with Steve Neveu.
Yeah. Coming up.
Yep. Who was over. Oh, by the way, I missed the best part of the story.
Oh,
when we were staring at that fish in the net.
Yep.
There. And we were both, first of all, staring at and before we even said that, we're staring at it. And Steve just looks up and says, "And that's why I brought the big net." He just said it. It was hilarious. And then we said, But I forgot all about that. But the first thing he said to me, he goes, "And that's why I brought the big net." And that's
nice.
That was, anyways, we were fishing.
That's the best.
So nowadays, where the organization, the CISA and Canada Bass and stuff and thing, there's a qualifying process to make the team.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have to fish a qualifier. And in fact, starting next year, the qualification tournament will be an invitation tournament. So it'll be based on, you know, the top so many teams in this circuit, and top so many teams in this circuit, and obviously, well, there's always the invitation to anybody who fishes the elites or the opens down in the States, etc. Toyota Series, whatever. You know, Eric Luzak, yeah. Evan Kung, Danny McGarry, Paul Bouvier, all those guys. So we were fishing the qualifier this year was on the St. Lawrence River. And Steve and I weighed in 27.8 to win the qualifier. That's a good bag.
That's a real good bag.
I think we won by 3 or 4 pounds. And we won big fish with my biggest fish in a tournament weighed in, a 7.49.
Nice.
Smallie. And Steve was saying, "So I've gotten to net your biggest smallie ever, and I've gotten to net your biggest smallie in a tournament."
Nice.
There was a common denominator there, you know, obviously. But you know what? And people know me, know that I try to be, you know, as open and honest when it comes to tournament, you know. You know, when it comes to tournament anglers, you know, you can usually tell they're lying because their lips are moving.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So in my case, you know, unless, you know, if you ask me after day one of a 2-day event, I'm not going to say too much.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just.
But you'll say, "I'm not going to say too much."
Yeah.
But you're not going to say, I'm not going to lie and tell you.
Besides, I believe people who do that, karma comes back and bites them on that.
Oh, yeah.
Because then that person will go out and do that, and they'll have a huge bag. And "I did exactly as you told me." And the guy's going, "Well, I told him bullshit." And going, "Well,
I know."
But anyways, so I caught that fish on a Carolina rig.
Yep.
And even then, like a Carolina rig, I would say the hookup ratio is fairly high, like very high.
Yeah.
and your landing ratio is very high.
Yeah.
But again, you really will never land every single fish. I don't care what presentation you use, but a single hook, obviously, I think gives you your best odds of landing a fish. So even that day, we weighed 27.8. I do believe if we land, we lost two fish, and I'm pretty sure those two fish would have put us over 30 pounds for the day.
Wow.
Not that it matters. You know, we won. So, you know, whether you win by 3 pounds, 4 pounds, 6 pounds, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
You know, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But when you have a single hook, same with, you know, if you're drop shotting, that single drop shot hook, even it may be a smaller hook, but you've noticed, I'm sure you notice when you're drop shotting, how many times that hook is right in his horn.
Right in the beak.
And when it's in there, that's the best place to hook him with a single hook in the horn.
You got to make sure that you get that hook set so that the point is facing up on the drop shot, right?
Yeah. Well, you got to tie it properly.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know.
Yeah, you're setting yourself up to win. You always want that hook
to be sitting up,
Yeah.
And when it bites and it gets in the thing.
Yeah. And then, you know, one of the presentations that I love, and, you know, the hookup percentage is better, is just a wacky rig Senko. You know, the Senko in any situation, I really love those baits.
The French River. In the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing, like yourself and whatever, it's great. My biggest concern with things like Senkos,
they're big.
Is the fact that a lot of people use them, and yes, they catch fish on them, but they don't actually feel the bite. And a lot of the times that fish ends up being gut hooked.
Oh, well, that's for sure.
That is a concern of mine.
Yeah.
You know, with guys who know what they're doing, they can feel it.
Yeah.
And they can get the hook in the right place. But most people are using it.
And you're absolutely right. I would guide a lot. I didn't guide a lot. What I did was take people fishing when my guides didn't show up. Right. You know, but
is it too drunk from the night before?
Well, you know, it could. There's a number of different reasons, and all of them are all of them result in not showing up,
right?
Whatever they are. Yeah. I would spend a lot of time coaching people with the Senkos, because, you know, the areas that I was fishing were fairly shallow, and, you know, drop shotting wasn't great in the weeds, and, you know, and yes, inevitably, if you don't know what you're doing with them, they eat them. They just eat them, you know.
Yeah.
Listen, that's wonderful insight from one of Canada's finest. And I'm really looking forward to the game, Pan Am Games this year. I'm not sure if we're going to be down there shooting them or not, but
I know there's been some talk.
You know what? When it comes to the big decisions, I'm like a mushroom around here. I just do what I'm told. You know, but between home and everything else, I just smile and do
nod
it.
Nod your head. So,
either way, I want to wish you the best of luck, and go and bring home gold.
We're gonna do our best. So
yeah,
we're definitely, because you know our friends, the Americans, are not going to send a weak team.
No, hell no. They're not.
They're going to send the best, and then a month right after that, believe it or not, we're going to fish the World Championship.
Nice.
Italy.
Oh, in Italy.
Yeah.
Jeez. I should see if Ann should. And we should shoot that one.
You should. Lake Bocina in Italy. It's about 2 hours outside of Rome.
Oh, good for you. That's awesome.
That's see, these things at this point of my career, fishing career and competitive career, would I still like to make the Bassmaster Classic? Sure. And if I get a chance to make it through like the team championship or through the nations, that's great. I would never go do the 9 EQ qualifiers, because it's just it's too much. You know,
brutal. It's a lot.
But things like wearing the maple leaf,
yeah,
That means way more to me. I know I'm not there. I know I'm not there to win money. I'm there just, you know, hopefully to win for Canada and win a medal. So,
well, I wish you all the best, and I thank you so much for coming on with us and talking to all of us. And Dave, it's been a pleasure, and I thank you for your friendship over the years.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for your friendship, my friend. We will get out, and I'll show you what a Vexus boat is all about this summer.
Oh, buddy, I would love to do that. I mean, those things look mean.
Yeah.
I can just imagine the performance.
It's the best, honestly.
I've owned
lots of boats over the years. And I've been in every type of boat there is out there. And this is the best boat I've ever
been. So. Well, I think that their performance would only be second to Dave Chong's performance at the Worlds this year.
Well,
because you're going to knock it out of the park, buddy. You're going to knock him out of the park.
We will. You know, it won't be for lack of trying. That's for
no. I know, buddy.
There'll be 110% effort in there. For we'll do everything we can to I think it's something special when you, in whatever sport you do, when you get to wear the maple leaf.
Yes,
it's special. It really is
absolutely
and
special.
And if you can't get up and you can't put it, you know, 110% into it, then you shouldn't have been there in the first place. Let somebody else who it means something to go, you know. And
well, and it takes that kind of dedication to get to where you are. Yeah. Even the qualifier this year, I'm sure that the competition at the qualifier was outstanding.
Well, there were a lot of teams that do very well in the St. Lawrence River, like top notch teams, and we were very proud of the fact that we beat them. And and since we've started qualifying process, I don't want to just toot my own horn here, but I think I shouldn't say I think, I know I am the only angler to actually have qualified in all three qualifiers.
Yeah.
Actually made the team. And believe it or not, I made it with a different partner each time, which is kind of interesting as well.
Nice. That's awesome. Well, hey, if you're looking for another partner next year.
Hey, who knows? You never know. Yeah. You never know. Like I said, this is what it is for me nowadays. I still want to fish tournaments, but you know, I do want to represent Canada, and I do want to fish more with friends like yourself and people who over the years I really have not had a chance to fish with, even though we keep talking about it. And but then, you know, time gets, you know, life gets busy and time goes by so fast,
and you blink your eyes one day and spring is here, and then next thing you know, it's snowing again.
Yep, we're ice fishing.
Oh yeah, exactly. So thanks again, my friend. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime, Steve.
That's no problem. And thanks to all of you out there listening to Diaries of a Lodge Owner. I just want to remind you all to go to fishingcanada.com and enter in and win. We've got contests always going, whether they're to, we did one for Lake Obabaka Lodge, Nordic Point Lodge with Will Pulowski, which is another fantastic place. Get over there, have a look. Not sure if there's lodges there, but there's always something to win. And
Garmin units. I've seen some Garmin units on
there's
there.
A smoking Garmin unit there right now.
Is there?
Best
electronics in the world.
Oh, yeah. No. So, and listen, thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it. And if you like the content, get out there, leave some comments, tell us how much you love Dave Chong and Go Canada Go and everything else. So, again, thank you, and we have now come to the conclusion of another episode of Diaries of a Lodge Owner.
I'm a good old boy, never meaning no harm. I'll beat all you ever saw, been reeling in the hog since the day I was born. Bending my rod, stretching my line. So Someday I might own a lodge and that'd be fine. I'll be making my way, the only way I know how. Working hard and sharing the North with all of my pals. Well, I'm a good old boy. I bought a lodge and lived my dream. And now I'm here talking about how life can be as good as it seems. Yeah.
What brings people together more than fishing and hunting?
How about food?
I'm Chef Antonio Maleca, and I have spent years catering to the stars. Now, on Outdoor Journal Radio's Eat and Wild podcast, Luigi, Hookset, and I are bringing our expertise
and Rolodex to our real passion, the outdoors.
Each week, we're bringing you inside the boat, tree stand, or duck blind and giving you real advice that you can use to make the most out of your fishing game.
You're going to flip that duck breast over once you get a nice hard sear on that breast. You don't want to sear the actual meat.
And it's not just us chatting here. If you can name a celebrity, we've probably worked with them. And I think you might be surprised who likes to hunt and fish.
When Kit Harington asks me to prepare him sashimi with his bass, I couldn't say no.
So whatever Taylor Sheridan wanted, I made sure I had it.
Burgers, steak, anything off the barbecue. That's a true cowboy.
All Jeremy Renner wanted to have was lemon ginger shots all day.
Find Eating Wild now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Back in 2016, Frank and I had a vision to amass the single largest database of muskie angling education material anywhere in the world.
Our dream was to harness the knowledge of this amazing community and share it with passionate anglers just like you.
Thus, the Ugly Pike podcast was born and quickly grew to become one of the top fishing podcasts in North America.
Step into the world of angling adventures and embrace the thrill of the catch with the Ugly Pike podcast. Join us on our quest to understand what makes us different as anglers and to uncover what it takes to go after the infamous fish of 10,000 casts.
The Ugly Pike podcast isn't just about fishing. It's about creating a tight-knit community of passionate anglers who share the same love for the sport. Through laughter, through camaraderie, and an unwavering spirit of adventure, this podcast will bring people together.
Subscribe now and never miss a moment of our angling adventures. Tight lines, everyone.
Find Ugly Pike now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.